From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The approach of summer promises a bounty of fresh fruits and vegetables to choose from. But when you pick out those juicy plums or ripe tomatoes from your favorite grocery produce section, do you stop to question where and how they were grown? Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute, has some ideas about that. She talks about the future of farming, from genetic editing to collaborative robots to urban indoor warehouse farms. She also offers some perspective about agricultural technology.
What we're talking about here is not some kind of catastrophic biological weapon. We're talking about speeding up what is already a biological process in order to optimize the things that we use.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Soon, grocery stores will be bursting with the spoils of summer. Tons of tomatoes, bundles of basil, piles of potatoes. But do you always know for certain where and how they were grown? And might the answers to those questions be different in a few years? Strategic futurist Amy Webb has some thoughts about farming. We talked with her last summer about the role technology plays in agriculture and what lies ahead. Webb is founder of the Future Today Institute, which researches emerging technologies as they move from the fringe to the mainstream. She's also professor of strategic foresight at New York University's Stern School of Business. I asked her to describe what the future of farming might look like and how it would function.
You know, what's so interesting is when we think of farms, we tend to think of wide open spaces.
Mm-hmm.
If you drive west of Baltimore, you're in beautiful farm country. And what's so fascinating is that the farms of the future will probably look quite different. In fact, some of them, which already exist in downtown Tokyo, Japan, are farms that are actually indoors. They're inside of office buildings. They line the vertical wall spaces of very, very modern buildings in a very technologically forward country. And rather than seeing huge expanses of space, instead you see what looks like a traditional office building that is lined with rows of tables that have hydroponic plants growing on them and walls where there are plants that produce, you know, vegetables and fruit. And in a lot of cases, there are robotic arms which have a sort of articulated extension and are capable of moving around. You know, in a lot of more modern farms around the United States, robotics are already in use. So there are special robots that are capable of picking apples. On potato farms, there are already robots that are able to pick and sort potatoes and discard those that aren't going to make the perfect chip. So robots are already in use. I think what we're talking about is really a different way of approaching modern agriculture in a smarter, more technological way.
Well, I think some of us, you mentioned hydroponic, and we've seen hydroponic lettuce in the regular grocery store, and we kind of get the idea that it's sort of at the edge, you know, for a little bit of salad or for a garnish, this odd way of growing. But you're talking about a much bigger scale. You're talking about this being the main source of food.
I know it's a hard image to conjure up. What's important to keep in mind is that it's not just the robots that are worth our attention, and it's not just the code that tells the robots how to move. It's really the conflation of several different emerging technologies that all point toward a different type of farm in the future. So there are what are called collaborative robots, and these are robots that each perform different functions and are capable of handing tasks off to each other. Not too far from downtown Baltimore, Amazon has a major distribution center where there are lots of collaborative robotics already being used. So rather than the warehouse, we're talking about instead a place where fruit and vegetables and livestock are grown. So collaborative robotics, different types of growing techniques, but also different ways of filtering and using light. So all of those combine with something called CRISPR-Cas9, which is a genetic editing technique. And what that allows for is a very slight difference in the genetic makeup of produce or even livestock. And the result of that is a way to grow much more of a particular plant or vegetable or fruit using far fewer resources, enabling us to grow them indoors in strange places.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with futurist Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute, which researches and analyzes technology trends. We're talking about the future of farming. So how widespread is this now?
So this is what I would categorize as a mid-futures scenario. So there's no place that you can – there's no farm where you can sort of, you know, walk to right now where you'll see all of these different robots and crazy configurations in play. So this is still sort of emerging from the fringe. And what we're really talking about in terms of a time horizon looks like 10 to 20 years. So this is not something that is tomorrow, but it is absolutely within our scope. It's on the horizon.
And what are the primary reasons companies are developing these methods to grow food?
You know, there's a lot of different reasons. One is that farming is difficult. It's really hard work. Even if you're a hobbyist like I am and you have a container garden or a small garden at home, you know how difficult it can be to do something that seems so simple, like grow a tomato that's edible. It's actually a lot harder to do than I think we give the farming industry credit for. So part of what's happening is making crop yields more reliable, making that work more sustainable over a longer period of time, and to solve for some endemic challenges within agriculture that have always existed. But on top of that, we have things like extreme weather patterns and climate change. It's highly plausible that in some of the major agricultural centers around the world, they're not going to be able to produce food like they used to. Bangladesh alone is probably facing over the next few decades massive sea level rises, you know, and the people who live within Bangladesh are likely to become refugees in their own country. So another reason why a lot of this research is pushing forward more quickly is because our global food supply is going to become more scarce than it has in the past due to big changes in weather, but also growing populations. So we've got to figure out a way to create more produce and to be able to produce it more regularly and with better sustainability in mind for a growing number of people.
And let me make sure I'm following. When you talk about something more reliable, it's by pulling it indoors that you're protecting the farming process from weather.
Right. So there are lots of different ideas being batted around at the moment. So some of it is, can we create sort of enormous indoor plant factories? So think of the largest factories that you've seen, you know, on the internet or on television. And instead of making widgets, they're making wedges of lettuce. Right. So growing indoors. But another really interesting area is continuing to grow outside, but creating new strains of plants that require far less water and can tolerate far worse conditions like extreme droughts and intense heat. And that's where there's some really interesting work that's currently being done. So, for example, and the reason that I like this for Baltimore, you know, is I could easily see lots of different plots of land around the city of Baltimore where those tiny pieces of a neighborhood block could become the agricultural center for that neighborhood. And that means fresh produce that could be theoretically shared by everybody who lived nearby. And the produce wouldn't necessarily be that difficult to grow if it's being modified in a way that best suits Baltimore's climate and, atmosphere and rainfall and everything else.
So the future that you're looking at is not necessarily just for corporate forming?
Well, so again, this is, I think, right now we're sort of the technology is emerging from the fringe. So the business models have not yet been built. Some of the models that I've built to speculate what the risk and opportunity scenarios might be for the future do include big corporate consolidation. So, you know, I could easily see how a Walmart, for example, could decide that it's going to integrate and rather than import and, you know, import and sell produce, grow that produce within the store, which would cut down significantly on a lot of its costs. So, you know, it could turn every Walmart in the country into a micro farm where that produce is grown and services the local community. Now, Walmart's not working on that right now, but part of thinking this way is getting ahead of what that future might look like, because I also think it's entirely plausible, given that Amazon has acquired Whole Foods, that we could also look at a future scenario where every single Whole Foods, which is owned by Amazon, becomes that neighborhood food distribution center where the food is grown there. The key difference between Walmart and Amazon is that Amazon is sitting on a massive pile of data, which would allow it to potentially optimize better for that local community. So I think when we think about agriculture and farming and food, you know, people tend to think of Monsanto, for example, or Purdue Farms, right? And those will be the companies of the future that sort of control the global or at least our national food supply. I don't actually know that that's necessarily true going forward.
That's Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute, which analyzes technology trends. We're talking about technology's influence on the future of farming. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. After a short break, we'll ask about the drawbacks of burgeoning agricultural technology. Stay tuned.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Today, we're revisiting a discussion about farming and how technology is playing into its development. We continue our conversation with Amy Webb, analyst and strategist of technology trends and the founder of the Future Today Institute. We talked about what parts of the world are leading the way in agricultural technology.
You know, I would say that there are pockets of significant development around the world. So Israel is one of the global leaders in hydroponics and also desalinization, in part because of where they're geographically located. Japan is the global leader when it comes to collaborative robotics and applying that technology to other fields that are adjacent, in this case, you know, agriculture. And, of course, the United States has been a key player in pushing through new types of technologies and breeding techniques. And I would also say China. China at the moment is helping to lead a lot of the major studies around genomic editing for livestock and for produce. And China is significant because it doesn't have the same type of regulations as other countries do around the world. And I would especially highlight in that case the European Union, which has very strict guidelines around the use of genetic editing techniques and technologies.
Yeah, we haven't really talked about public reaction to any of this. There certainly has been resistance to genetically modified foods.
You know, I think people hear genetically modified and they instantly think of some kind of Franken broccoli, yeah. Right? That could cause all kinds of problems down the road. But, you know, what we're talking about here is not some kind of catastrophic biological weapon. We're talking about speeding up what is already a biological process. So this is not about enhancing with, you know, foreign chemicals, enhancing our broccoli and turning our broccoli pink. This is about copying, pasting, and editing what already occurs in nature in order to optimize the things that we use. And in this case, we're talking about vegetables, but also, you know, livestock. So China and South Korea have both used genomic editing to create double-muscled pigs. And
double-muscled pigs.
Right. So
bulked up pigs with
lots
of flesh.
These are not household pet pigs,
yeah,
obviously. Right. So the idea here is they've engineered a pig that requires, you know, less resources and care, but grows twice the muscle. And obviously these are being grown for human consumption.
There's also research into creating meat without using animals.
That's right. And there's two different ways that that's being done. There's a really fascinating company called Memphis Meats, which is not based in Tennessee, but based in California, in San Francisco. And they are doing fascinating research around growing within a lab meat-like products, that are cultured rather than, you know, grown in a traditional way on a farm. And there are also companies that are starting with the organic tissue of livestock and then attempting to, from that, reproduce and grow a steak that, you know, it chemically is exactly the same as a steak you might get from a cow, but didn't require the significant resources that it currently takes to grow and maintain a herd. Right. I mean, it's pretty significant.
How would the kind of thing we're talking about, ag tech developments you're describing, affect other industries besides farming?
When I talk to people about the future of agricultural technologies, you know, they always kind of look at me strange because, you know, usually it's like, well, why do I care about this? Futurists tend to spend a lot of time looking at agriculture because it connects to every other facet of life. So if you're a human, you need food, and your food comes from a farm. So that's one reason to pay attention to what's happening. But there are all of these businesses and government agencies who sit adjacent to what happens in agriculture who ought to be paying attention as well. And let me give you a quick example as to why that's the case. So let's say, and again, given what we know to be true today and the data that we have access to, this could all change. But given what we know to be true today, let's say that over the next 15 years, because of developments in genomic editing, collaborative robotics, pattern recognition, and artificial intelligence, it's plausible that big box retailers all over the country will begin growing their own produce, growing and distributing their produce. So that becomes a real benefit to people who live in the United States. But now let's think through that, you know, who that disrupts. So if a huge big box retailer is no longer importing their food from somewhere else, that means that the people who make the barcode scanners, which is used to track a package as it moves, that's no longer needed. The entire delivery system, from the forklift drivers to the truck drivers to the people who make the cardboard boxes, like to the ink that is stamped under those cardboard boxes, that disrupts, if you think about the movement of produce, right, that disrupts that entire supply chain. But it also potentially disrupts the geopolitical balance, because in a lot of countries around the world, the United States is a major trade partner for agricultural products. And if we no longer have a need to import bananas, let's say, or whatever the product might be, you know, that could decimate another country's economy if the United States suddenly shut the tap off, you know, which could then over time, you know, lead to less opportunity within that country, job loss, instability, civil unrest, you know, and if there's enough pocket of activity all around the world, you know, we could potentially see some pretty horrific outcomes. So what I would say to people when they're thinking about agricultural tech and genomic editing is that You know, there is risk involved, but it's not dangerous fruits and vegetables, you know. And I would also just use history as context. Do you remember Dolly the sheep?
Sure.
Right. And do you remember what happened when Dolly the sheep was revealed collectively?
A lot of attention, a lot of press attention.
We freaked out. Everybody lost their minds because of this sheep that had been cloned using what had at that point become a new but increasingly common genetic editing technique. I think the word clone is what scared people because of our pop culture references. And what happened in the decades since, we wound up with new techniques. We wound up with better research. And, you know, if you ask people on the street about Dolly today, they'll either have forgotten about it until you remind them, or they won't have that same visceral emotional connection. I would say that two decades in the future, we're going to be having that same like, oh, what was the big deal with this genetically modified produce and livestock? Why were we, you know, why did we have that instant aversion to it?
That's Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute, here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the high-tech future of farming. Webb's most recent book is The Big Nine, How the Tech Titans and Their Thinking Machines Could Warp Humanity.
Let me ask you to summarize what the best-case scenario of how this could play out is and the worst case.
Sure. So if I were to summarize and offer an optimistic framing for the best possible outcome, let's say 15 years into the future, I would say that we have an agricultural landscape that is regulated in a meaningful way, which is to say not overly regulated, that there's a healthy amount of competition, that we have developed lots of different avenues to create sustainable produce and sustainable livestock, whether that's cultured or cultivated, in a way that really does start to address the global food shortage crisis that we are likely to face over the next several decades. And that within our own country and within the city of Baltimore, all of these really promising agricultural technologies mean that residents have access to fresh produce at reasonable prices. And as a result, we're all living healthier. But let me give you a catastrophic worst case scenario over the next 15 years. You know, I think that there's a couple of possible forks. So one is that the technology is hyper-regulated and that one or maybe just a few organizations own the patents and the rights to use these technologies. And as a result, we wind up with one or two major producers and providers of produce and livestock in the United States. And to me, that's problematic because it not only means that we have less choice, but it means we're literally putting a lot of eggs into a singular basket. And to me, that's concerning when we're talking about the food supply. Another potentially catastrophic outcome would be destabilization, the geopolitical destabilization. You know, I think we oftentimes forget about the influence that the United States wields on countries outside of our own borders. And regulations and decisions that are made because they seem politically advantageous in the United States can, you know, have a ripple effect that reaches not just the governments of other countries, but the individuals who live in those countries who have to deal with the consequences. So I think for me, the worst case scenario would be that we push all of this technology ahead and make these great strides without also thinking about the social ramifications, which could be quite serious and potentially catastrophic in other countries around the world.
So what advice would you give about how to tip to your optimistic scenario versus your scary scenario?
So as with everything that involves humans and technology, there is no way to accurately predict the future. The best possible thing that we can do is make connections, given what we see in the present, and do some serious long-term planning. So it would be terrific if people who are interested in this subject think things through and collect information and work in some cross-functional teams to map out the next 10 to 15 to 30 years. there's actually a terrific source for information on emerging technologies and farming. And I know this is going to sound crazy, but the publication is called Modern Farmer. And even if you're not all that interested in commercial farming, there's a lot of really interesting accessible information about tech and food and where your food comes from. And it's also really well designed. So
I really appreciate you walking us through it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Amy Webb, founder of the Future Today Institute, which researches emerging technologies as they move from the fringe to the mainstream. She spoke with us last summer about agricultural technology and the future of farming. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, links to more information about it, to Webb's newsletter, and to the online publication she recommended called Modern Farmer. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.